Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. I'm Dan Rettina, the founder of Dan's Papers, and my guest today is Hugh King, who's the town crier in East Hampton and has been for about 2,000 years or so. And also, and maybe more interesting, is he also has a road, a street named for him, which is right on the sign in the middle of town.
It's an alley, Dan.
An alley, okay. He's in company. There are two people that the mayor has thought to honor, or at least put their name on these signs. One is Ina Garten, who's a prominent food writer, and the other is Glenn, who lives here and started the first store in East Hampton where prices were eight times what everybody else was selling anything for. And then you're the other.
Okay.
I'll introduce him by saying that Hugh is a confession. Hugh is a now retired, very highly regarded teacher at the Spring School who taught all four of my children.
That's right.
And when I see him, he asks me about one or another of them. And I think, well, he was a teacher there when they were little, all the way up through sixth grade, I think. And if you multiply that times the number of people in the room, the number of years that he did this, how the hell does he remember everything? So I will ask you that.
Well, your children were memorable, Dan.
Yep.
Okay. And they're still memorable today. That's why I always ask you what they're doing, right?
Right.
One of them is a principal, right, Maya?
She's fine. They're all fine.
Yeah.
So I thought you memorized everybody. I mean, yeah, would you get you on the sign?
Yeah, right.
There was a beloved guy who owned the ice cream parlor in Bridgehampton Candy Kitchen named George Philopoulos, I think.
Stravopoulos.
He got his name on a sign, and that's a trick because those are very narrow letters to get them all on that.
Yeah, right.
Well, how long have you been the town crier? And tell us a little bit about how you dress up when the phone rings and they say, you better get down here and be the town crier again today.
Well, it goes back to celebrating the Constitution of the 1989 or 1987 was the 200th anniversary of the Constitution. So I went around the school, Spring School, dressed up as a guy named King, who was one of the signers of it. And I was telling the students about what the Constitution was, because nobody knew. And then Fred Yardley, who was the teacher there, Tony Bullock, the supervisor, so they invited me to the town board meeting to talk about the Constitution. And then Tony Bullock had this suggestion, why don't we hire you for 20 appearances? You go to 20 different appearances around the town. We'll give you $50 an appearance.
Oh, a lot of money. It's a scandal.
Oh, I know. And you go and you talk about local history to people. And I started off going to the town board meetings. I went to the Kiwanis Club. I went to the LVIS. And that's how it started.
And were you dressed up as the town crier?
Yes, I was. I got a top hat and I got a vest and a dark pair of pants and short tie, I guess, and a bell, of course. And I still have the bells, you know.
Of course.
Yeah.
We just got through the 4th of July, and when I spoke to you about this at one point, you said, gotta run, they just called.
Who called?
I gotta go be the town crier. I said, I'll get off the phone. What was that occasion? Do you remember? It was just...
No, I don't remember what we're talking about. Well, wait a minute. I had to go to a village board meeting. That's what it was.
And well, that,
see, the village government appointed me as the village historian, and the town government appointed me as the town historian. So before every village board meeting, I get to talk about local history. And before every town board meeting, I get to talk about local history. Now, what a commitment to our government to allow a historian to speak before the meeting starts.
I think that's wonderful. It
Yeah.
also leads me to ask you, tell me perhaps your most favorite story of from all our history, or one of them.
You ready? In 1657, Elizabeth Howell, the daughter of Lion Gardner, the most famous man in East Hampton, died screaming she was killed by a witch. We had a witchcraft case in East Hampton 35 years before Salem. Did you know about that?
Yes.
You did. That's one of my favorite stories.
I even thought that's what you were going to talk about. She accused a woman who went to trial. She accused, her name was Goody Garlic, right?
Well, Goody, it's a title. It's short for goodwife. Her real name was Elizabeth Garlic, but yeah. And the case was sent to Connecticut.
Yeah, and why was it in Connecticut instead of here?
Well, first of all, the three magistrates had no idea of what to do with it. This was a capital case. The death penalty could arise from this. And we were under their jurisdiction. In 1655, we sent somebody over there to make sure we were under their jurisdiction in capital cases. And John Winthrop Jr. wanted East Hampton under his control to keep the Dutch from coming out here. So that's why the case was sent to Connecticut. And the three magistrates in East Hampton had no idea what to do about this, you know.
How do we know that she was casting a spell?
Well, we don't. We have to take the word of Elizabeth Howell. Elizabeth Howell just had a baby. My wife, Loretta, who wrote the book about this case, posited that she had puerperal fever, which was something that women got after childbirth. Now, remember, childbirth in 1657, nobody washed their hands, you know. It was just hit or miss. So she was probably having hallucinations. But what happened is other women came up with some other stories about Goody Garlic. You know, she picked up my baby and she looked in its eyes and she said, you know, this baby looks sick. And then 5 days later, the baby died. Or she borrowed breast milk from some woman and then 5 days later, the woman's breast milk dried up. Or when they were in Connecticut, she brought some herbs to somebody to help cure their fits. The woman said, I'm not going to take anything from her, and threw the herbs in the fire. And then a black cat showed up. Well, who has a black cat? Goody Garlic. You see, all these other stories then crop up. And that's why the magistrates sent it to Connecticut.
And what happened? What did they rule?
Well, she was lucky because the judge was John Winthrop Jr., who did not like witchcraft cases because they broke up communities. John Winthrop Jr. also knew Lion Gardner, and he also knew Joshua Garlic, the husband of Goody Garlic, because Joshua brought products back and forth between the two. So Winthrop Jr. said, it was a good idea that you sent her over here. You had just suspicions, but we have deemed her not guilty because in Connecticut, in order to be convicted of witchcraft, you had to be proven to have complicity with the devil. Well, how did you prove that? Well, they confessed, or you tortured them. They didn't torture people in Connecticut. So there was no way they could prove that she had complicity with devil. All those other things that people were talking about was called maleficium, harmful magic. But that wasn't enough to convict you in Connecticut. So they sent her back to East Hampton, not guilty.
And what became of her?
Well, you would have thought if you were accused of witchcraft and you were exonerated, you probably had to leave town.
Right.
Well, the Garlics prospered. He lived to be about 100 years old, and we think she lived pretty close to the same. He acquired more land when he came back here. He was trading animals and products, and their son became the miller. So the fate that other people went through that didn't happen to them.
I think the couple wind up on Gardner's Island.
No, that's one of the Gardner stories that showed up that they. Lion Gardner, see, the Gardner started the story that Lion Gardner saved her. Because when they sent her to Connecticut with all the witnesses, Lion Gardner and the two magistrates went along with them. But they went there to make sure we were still under their jurisdiction. We have no proof that he went over there and testified on her behalf or gave her a house on Gardner's Island later. There was a pond over there called Garlic Pond, but. I don't know. We don't know everything either, I could be wrong, you know what I mean?
I've come by the town cemetery in the center of town, by Town Pond out there. What are you telling people? I mean, usually there's a small crowd with you and you're talking about the graveyard and the flagpole and people
About
buried there. What is that
well, one of
story?
the best stories there is Tippecanoe and Tyler too. In 1840, William Henry Harrison ran for president, but they needed a vice presidential candidate, so they picked John Tyler, a Democrat from the South. So they get elected. Well, what happens to Harrison? He dies after 30 days, and then Tyler becomes president. First time that ever happened. And the Constitution said the vice president will take over the duties of the president if the president can't do it. It doesn't mean he becomes president, and Tyler set a precedent by moving right into the White House. And then his first wife dies, and into Washington comes Julia Gardner from Gardner's Island. And eventually they get married and move back to Virginia. So buried there are the mother and father of Julia Gardner, a first lady of the United States. And one of her sons, John Alexander Tyler, is buried there. So I always tell that story about Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
There's also another case that was up in Connecticut in which a former president was volunteered to come and speak about some slaves. Tell us that story.
I don't know that story.
That's a wonderful story.
Well, tell me. Who? Oh, the Amistad case. Well, the Amistad case, it started in, it didn't start there, but Montauk played a very important part in the Amistad case. And when you watch Spielberg's movie, he brushes right over Montauk because that's where they were captured and then brought back to Connecticut. So they get there, then I knew you're talking about John Quincy Adams.
Right.
Yes, he argued the case before the Supreme
They
Court, right?
were the, well, it's a very complicated story, but basically to go see the movie and Stephen, that might have been one of the things that Spielberg became interested in because he moved out to the East End.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So are you related and a descendant of the Mr. King that you spoke about earlier?
Yeah, I forgot his name. Rufus King. Rufus King was the signer of the Declaration of Independence. I doubt it. No. I just picked him because his name was King. That's all. But no, I'm not related, I'm pretty sure.
Were you born and raised here in the East
I
End?
was raised in Amagansett. I'm living in the house right now, Dan. We're talking. They're the house I grew up in because of the generosity of my sisters. Let me tell you the story. This doesn't happen. You know what happens out here when the parents die and there's the house and the children are away? Let's sell it because we get millions of dollars. My sisters didn't do that. They let me sell my house in Springs, give them the money, and they let me move into this house in Amagansett, which was great. But I was born in Brooklyn. Luckily, my father, who worked on the railroad, kept getting laid off. He kept getting furloughed. So he moved back to Amagansett, where he was born, and started his plumbing business right here in this house.
What kind of business?
A plumbing business. He was a plumber before they were called Mister, and there was no answering machine. So when the phone rang, my father had to pick it up. And if it was Sunday, he'd go out. He'd have to go out,
So you've seen the Hamptons change as I have. Well, maybe people listening to this might want to know what it was like when you were a boy. So in some ways, compare it to what is here today.
Well, I think we have to be careful about that because I'm looking across the street and the baseball field where we played is still there. I mean, I think we grew up here in happy days. I think we were really lucky. The summer people went away after the summer.
Yes.
They didn't stay. After Labor Day, everything went down. Now, the summer people were responsible for many of our cultural institutions out here. I mean, Guildhall. The library was the work of summer people. Buying Home Sweet Home Museum, the summer people supported that. But after September, they went away. So we're saying it wasn't it nice? It was nice and quiet here. It was great. But then we have to remember in the 1950s, Jim Crow was still around. Women were not supposed to go out and work. They were supposed to just stay home. So there were other things about the 50s that weren't so great. You know what I mean? But I don't want to live anywhere else. I don't care how crowded it gets here. I don't care. I don't care. I don't want to go anyplace else. And you grew up, you lived in Montauk, right?
I didn't grow up here. I was 16 when we moved here from a suburb in New Jersey.
Why did you move here?
My dad wanted to go fishing and was a pharmacist. So he found out that the drugstore in Montauk was for sale. So he bought it, and me and my sister and my mom moved out here in the mid-50s, just when things were starting to get rolling. One of the interesting things about that time, which it didn't occur to me for a while, was that Montauk was a motel town, and these were beautiful, brand new 50s modern hotels and motels, and the people staying in them were local folks. I'm sorry, not local. They were local people from New York and Long Island, not the social set at all. And East Hampton was very shocked when these places were all built about 3 or 4 years only before I got there. Some 30 motels got built.
And my father, plumbing business prospered because he worked on those motels in Montauk.
So until about 1950, Montauk was really sleepy and quiet. And East Hampton was too. I remember back then, the stores closed on Sunday. That was church.
Yes,
And
closed store. Yep.
I remember that the police used to, after the stores closed, they'd walk around town checking to make see the doors were locked on the
Yes, they did that in the village. Yep.
because there really wasn't anything worth stealing in any of
Yeah, you're
the
right.
dollar pocketbooks back then or something.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a change, and we had at that time had a very vigorous fishing community of locals going back to the settlers in East Hampton, particularly called the Bonnakers, and King was one of them in that family,
Yeah.
who were baymen and would catch fish from the shore and go out clamming and lobster pots and all that. And a lot of them moved away when this place blew up and became the resort it is today.
What about the striped bass too, right? That kind of hurt the fishing business, isn't it?
They went, a lot of them went to North Carolina.
They're still going to North Carolina. I don't know why. I don't want to go to North Carolina. Did you buy the business from Dick White's father, your father?
Yep.
Yeah, White's Pharmacy. Yeah.
My father was in the fire department, and my sister had a horse. She was kept up the Apollo Ranch. Anyway, that's a long story, and we're running out of time.
All right.
Was there a town crier such as you are now before you became the town crier?
That's a good question. I looked that up. I went through the town records, and in this volume two, when they're describing what they're paying for, they hired a town crier. It said payment for a town crier to beat the drum. That's how the town crier announced a meeting when the town board at the time was going to meet. He beat the drum because you were supposed to go to the meeting. And I've seen that in the town records, but after that, I didn't see any record of it all. But they also hired a town whipper to whip somebody for 25 shillings. We should bring that back.
Yes, we should bring it back. The shillings especially. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Has been great.
We're
Thank you for
so
asking
had a
me.
lot of fun talking to you about it.
All right, we'll do this again. Say hello to the kids.
Talk to you soon and see you soon.
Okay, we're out of here.
Bye bye.
Bye-bye.